It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In August 2018, a scathing report by a state grand jury documented how hundreds of Roman Catholic priests had sexually abused more than 1,000 children over several decades in the state of Pennsylvania. New research shows a mental health screening approach might help for future priests looking to join the order. Professor Anthony Isacco is an expert on the psychology of religion and spirituality at Chatham University, and he is leading a study into the psychology behind the issue. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, Kevin.
The grand jury report shows that 99 priests in the Pittsburgh diocese alone were considered predator priests. Your research, your study suggests that there are ways to mitigate the issue through screening prior to admission to a seminary. What exactly does that look like?
You know, what was nice about the research is that we were able to gather, you know, perspectives from scholars and psychologists across the country and even in Canada, and put together a real special issue in the professional psychology literature. And what we saw was an emergence of themes where, you know, we could do a better job of doing a comprehensive evaluation, but also being more accurate in identifying personality deficits and risk factors in those applicants.
Some specifics of a diagnostic test, of a personality test.
Well, the key to the evaluation is how comprehensive it should be. And there's not one single test that is a silver bullet to answering this question. So it's important to have a combination of personality measures, psychopathology measures, a clinical interview, gathering collateral information, meeting with the applicant over a period of time, for clinical interviewing, and then really putting all of that together and comparing and contrasting it with the professional literature and the science. So what we are trying to advocate is that psychologists really need to do a good job of the comprehensiveness of the evaluation and to really improve the rigor. And the good news is a lot of psychologists are already doing that. And this research will just kind of push us further in that direction.
In 2006, 4 years after the Boston Globe's groundbreaking investigation of clergy abuse across the country, U.S. bishops adopted stricter norms for screening applicants for the seminary, including careful psychological assessments, evaluation of a candidate's psychosexual maturity. Do you feel that their screening is lacking something?
Well, it was really important that the Catholic Church in America come up with some guidelines for psychologists. And they first came out in about 2008, and then they updated those guidelines in 2015. And what that did was it helped to create a standardization and a consistency. We still have a lot of work to do. And that was one of the issues that we want to address in our research, was to get more psychologists talking to each other about what they do and why they do it, to really help us move the ball forward in terms of establishing best practices that can be widely applied.
What sort of, we'll say, red flags would render someone no longer considered for admission to a seminary, do you feel?
There's several: emotional immaturity, an inability to cope with daily stress or acute stress, buildup of negative emotions, evidence of impulsivity, problematic sexual behavior, including pornography use, a lack of social support or a lack of an ability to develop intimate, close personal relationships at the friendship level, social isolation that isn't easily explained. So those are some of the more specific risk factors that we look for and that we screen for, and that we would communicate in a report to the diocese, for example, to say, hey, this person might not be ready, they might not be a good candidate, and here's why.
What's been the response from the church? Have you talked with Pittsburgh Bishop David Zubik or other church leaders?
Well, the church leaders here in Pittsburgh have been very collaborative with me through this research. Bishop Zubik gave me his approval to do this research and gave me access to data that I needed. And then it filtered down from there in terms of other church leaders in the diocese. They've been informed of the findings, and I think they see the value in this kind of research and the fact that they know that I'm putting into practice too. And so I think for me and for them, it's kind of a win-win situation where we can really critically look at what we're doing from a scientific perspective and then apply it in good faith.
Do you think they'll make any changes, maybe more strict greening process?
Well, it's a very rigorous screening process already, and I know they're always open to my suggestions, my input, and consultation. And so changes have already happened over the last 2 years, and I can see us, you know, tweaking things and making changes for the better moving forward.
Do you think that this could help the church rebuild trust and maybe even, you know, get people to return who maybe gave up after that grand jury report?
You know, of course, these are professional articles in the special issue. So the primary audience are going to be other psychologists and academics. But I definitely had victims in mind, the everyday Catholic in mind, whenever I put together the special issue and wrote these articles and collected them, including those Catholics that left the church because of the sexual abuse crisis. And a lot of what I've heard from people I know in those categories is that, you know, the church doesn't change, it's never going to change, or the change wasn't kind of good enough. And I think the research that I've been able to do, as well as my colleagues across the country and Canada, show that change is possible. We are moving the needle towards a more healthy clergy and a more healthy church around these issues. And so I really hope that those audiences take note of what has been done and what will be done from here and come on back and be part of the positive work that's being done.
Professor Anthony Isacco is an expert on the psychology of religion and spirituality at Chatham University and leading a study into the psychology behind the issue. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The past year has been a catalyst for conversations that are sometimes ignored. The importance of mental health, racial equity in the justice system. Amachi Pittsburgh has been having these conversations for years. The organization serves families and kids with incarcerated parents, providing programs and one-on-one mentoring. Anna Hollis is the executive director for Amachi Pittsburgh. Anna, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Kevin, for having me.
Before the pandemic, you had a couple of programs, one in school, one in the community, that included one-on-one mentoring. Obviously, lots of time in person. How's that changed since March?
Wow, it has changed dramatically. I'll tell you that when the pandemic first began, however, and you know, the Zoom technology was still a novelty for many, you know, our students still participated in our programming all the way through the end of the school year. So we were actually surprised by that. But what we found in the fall after the summer break, when kids were, you know, there was so much uncertainty, as you can recall, we were starting with our new class of students who didn't know our staff as well, obviously. I mean, they would be new to our staff. The students were new to us. So what we recognized is that, you know, in the spring when this first happened, we had already had a relationship with the kids. And we think that that was the reason that they continued to participate. But in the new school year, I mean, on top of some Zoom fatigue and I think frustration with not being able to return to school with their friends, the students were just not as engaged. And it was just really, really difficult. You know, it's difficult to get to know someone on Zoom.
Yeah. Any way to assess the effectiveness of those remote relationships rather than that personal touch, that in-person connection?
You know, typically we conduct surveys annually or every 6 months for our newer matches. And we decided to delay those assessments, you know, just by a couple of months because there were so many other issues to resolve, just so many, you know, challenges that our families were facing and, you know, that were affecting our youth. And so I think our team just became more heavily engaged in case management and supporting our families and making sure that they were able to navigate the systems and able to access the resources that they needed.
Right. The emotional support that you provide during normal times, was that increased, the need for that, exacerbated by the pandemic? And if so, how have you had to adjust?
Absolutely, 100%. One of the things we did early on was conducted a survey of all of our families because we needed to understand how they were being impacted specifically. Our families, there were no two families alike. You know, one of the things that's special about Amachi is that we don't try and do it all. We really leverage community partnerships. And then something else we did for our parents, because we heard this commonly that, you know, they hadn't been contacted by other agencies. Maybe they weren't, you know, necessarily connected to other agencies. And they really appreciated us reaching out and just having the opportunity to have adult conversation, mm-hmm. you know, and really to just talk about how stressful all of the, you know, sort of effects of the pandemic in their lives. And so we wanted to just do more of that. And so we made our reach out to the families routine. And we also created a platform, you know, just for a way for parents to connect with each other, you know, really talking about what's working.
This summer sparked a lot of conversations about racism in our institutions. How do you incorporate racial justice into the work you do?
That is really core to Amachi as a national model. It's a national mentoring model. And it's embedded in this model is recognition of racial injustice and racial inequities through mass incarceration. And that is why the model itself was designed to really address children who were impacted by parental incarceration because it had become so pervasive. You know, we specifically have an Amachi Ambassadors program, which is for high schoolers to really have that conversation about racial equity and to understand how they can become civically engaged in addressing those issues that affect their lives. I know that folks who are working in the criminal justice system and in public safety are thinking about, you know, public safety, they're thinking about how adults are affected or, you know, address folks who are engaged in the criminal justice system, but it hasn't been a lot of thought about how children and families are indirectly or directly impacted. And so this program for us is an opportunity for kids to understand that, to find their voice and to understand how to use their own experiences in, you know, coming up with solutions that they feel will help to improve their lives in their communities and their schools.
Anna Hollis is the executive director of Amachi Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When the state recently changed its coronavirus vaccine policy, 4 million Pennsylvanians became eligible to get their shots. People who are 65 or older found themselves competing with younger and sometimes more tech-savvy people to book their appointments. WITF's Brett Schultes reports, in some cases, social media and internet skills are giving those younger people an edge.
82-year-old Charles Wilkins and his wife have been holed up, as he puts it, for almost a year, trying their best to follow the rules and outlast the virus that is especially deadly for people 65 and older.
You know, we do curbside pickups. We rarely go in a store or anything else. Of course, our church is closed down, and we're very active members in that, but they're planning on opening that up for Easter. They're hoping to be able to, and we want to try to get our shots and stuff before that.
When their local pharmacies in Fayette County started getting shipments of vaccines, the couple started trying to schedule appointments. They've spent a lot of time doing this.
Oh, gosh. Probably, I would say an hour a day between the two of us. And it's been like a month or more that we've been trying to do it. So we do it every day.
Like more than a dozen people who shared their experiences trying to get vaccines, Charles describes navigating a patchwork of websites that eat up a person's time and offer little prospect of a follow-up.
You got to fill in all your information, and then it says, sorry, we have nothing available.
He says after a month's worth of effort, he's only gotten one reply from his county health department. But that reply just says they'll let him know when they have vaccines ready. Just one county north of Charles in the Pittsburgh area, David Masenda has had much better luck. Though to be clear, the 42-year-old chemical engineer and his wife also really had to work for it.
We probably put in about 16 hours.
When David says they had to get qualified, what he means is that they had to show that they were non-paid caregivers for a high-risk person. And Dave has a really important reason to want to get the vaccine.
For us, the rush to go and get qualified for the COVID vaccine was the fact that we have a current 2-year-old that's in T-cell lymphoma chemotherapy treatment.
David says once they knew they'd be able to get their shots, he and his wife, quote, carpet bombed the websites of clinics and pharmacies all over Pennsylvania with requests. But much like Charles Wilkins, they also didn't have much success.
I received an email from one of them, I think, over the weekend, again, just saying, yeah, we don't know when we're getting more vaccine. We'll contact you later.
But then they started really working social media. As the parents of a 2-year-old with cancer, they had a compelling story, and they got into Facebook groups where they found a pharmacist looking for people to contact in case they had extra doses. Within hours, they were rolling up their shirt sleeves to get their inoculations.
It's basically having connections and being in social media groups.
Even though it benefited him, David says the current system isn't really fair. He says the state website is not helpful for most people.
Again, I look at it as from an engineer standpoint, it's poorly planned and it's poorly executed.
While every story is a bit different, this is part of a broader problem. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation study shows fewer than 10% of Pennsylvanians 65 and up have been able to get at least one dose of vaccine. At a Thursday news conference, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf said that a person's place in line shouldn't be based on how well they can use the internet. He says a bipartisan group of state officials are about to meet to discuss options to improve access for vulnerable people. Wolf and Department of Aging Secretary Robert Torres point to regional area agencies on aging as good starting points for older people to find out where they can get a vaccine. Back in Pittsburgh, David Masenda says he's grateful that his daughter Bridget is in remission and that he and his wife will soon get their second doses, giving them one thing less to worry about while they take care of the 2-year-old. In nearby Fayette County, Charles Wilkins says he and his 70-year-old wife hope to be able to visit her mother, who's 98 and in a nursing home.
I think one of the most important things to us right now is being able to go see her mom up in Rochester, New York.
Charles says, just like every day over the past month, tomorrow he plans to log on to those local pharmacy websites and hope for the best. In Harrisburg, I'm Brett Schultes.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.